Good morning, everyone. Boker Tov. Bruchim Abayim. Delighted to welcome all of you this morning and our special guest now arriving on the screen, live in Chicago, Dr. Erica Brown. Beginning Poschim B'Chvod Achsanya, we thank the Kollel office and all of the various people who arranged the technical aspects of this morning. And we give a special thank you to Eddie Bess and family sponsoring this year, once again, pre-Pesach, special opportunity for us to learn together with very distinguished members of the Jewish community from around the world this year. Delighted to welcome Dr. Erica Brown. The Bess family is sponsoring this year in memory of their patriarch, their father, Mr. Michael Bess, Zichron Lebrach, as the Shama should have an Aliyah. And today we are delighted to welcome Dr. Erica Brown. Dr. Brown is the director of the Mayberg Center for Jewish Education and Leadership and an associate professor of curriculum and pedagogy at the George Washington University in Washington. She lives in Silver Spring. She is a renowned author and speaker and educator. For today's purposes, it's important to note, in your pre-Pesach reading, you should make sure to get a hold of Seder Talk, which is her book on the Haggadah, one of 12 books which she has written. And without any further ado, without taking more time, we are so excited and honored to welcome Dr. Erica Brown. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. It's such a delight to be here, Rabbi Brand. Thank you so much for having me. And I want to thank a special shout out to Tracy Schultz and those who organized this lecture and those who are sponsoring this. I actually want to join you in that sponsorship. I always like to learn in someone's memory, and teach in someone's memory is a special zchut, a special privilege. And I want to invite any of you who may have an upcoming yard site this week or maybe a refuah shlema for someone to please put it in the chat room. I have to share with you that this learning is very special to me today for a number of reasons. I could say because it makes there's a vacuum cleaner and someone's cleaning my car and in the background. So I got out of a little bit of cleaning, although I did the dining room this morning. But I lost my uncle yesterday, Aaron Ben Yitzchak. And I would like to dedicate the learning in his memory. As we know, loss during the time of COVID is particularly difficult, and going to funerals on Zoom of relatives who live far away has been really challenging. So it's really, I feel very special to be with you this morning.
Someone should have an Aliyah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm going to pass that on to my aunt because I know this is special for her too.
Please do.
So I want to talk about what goes into the making of a hero. And I want to think a little bit with you about how we bring our heroes to the Seder table. On one level, because it's a v'igadata levincha, this is the act, perhaps the most significant act of Jewish continuity over the course of a Jewish calendar year, is the notion of having a multi-generational table, which I know for some families has been compromised last year and this year. And I want to make just a suggestion as to how we sort of fill that out a little bit more this year that is tied into what I hope will be an understanding of Moshe's early years. And that is to take family photos of different people, also generational. You know, we have photos of my great-great-grandparents from Zakrzewek, Poland, photos, any photos that you have, and bring them to the Seder table, right? Because we're not only talking about a Seder plate, we're talking about the most significant family ritual of all time. And so let's bring the family there. And if you can't be with your grandparents for the Seder, you know, like, I'm not saying a life-size cutout, but it's nice to have photos and really feel the continuity that there were people in our lives who lived we're descendants of people who've been observing this holiday for a long time, and allow the children to question, who are these people? Let me get to know them, because that's part of the chain and part of the precious link that we have. So let's talk about Moshe. If you read Moshe's early story, and that's where I want to focus today, even though Moshe's name does not appear more than once in our Haggadah, his presence is really everywhere. His presence is everywhere and in everything. And I've always been intrigued what goes into making a leader. I do a lot of work in leadership development, and Howard Gardner wrote a book, Leading Minds, where he took, I think, 11 or 12 major figures on the world stage, Eleanor Roosevelt and Mahatma Gandhi and I'm trying to think of all of them, but Winston Churchill, and really tried to understand, is there something similar about these leaders that sort of position them for greatness? And one of the things that's striking is, I think that in Sefer Shemot, we get that story. And there's a reason we get that story, as a way of understanding what might we need to do if we wanted to do something extraordinary for the Jewish people. Now, I'll say that with the special caveat that we do not get that when it comes to Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu is just told in the beginning of Breishit Yud-Bet, this is what you need to do, right? And then it's up to Avraham to say if he wants to join in that or not. That's very different. And in fact, the Rambam in Hilchot Avodah Zarah spends two chapters trying to describe for us, basing himself on Talmudic and Midrashic readings, the Avraham who spent the years between the age of 3 and 40 contemplating the universe, sort of an Aristotelian philosopher king that Avraham is in that story, and an iconoclast, and that's how he became who he was. But of course, that information is not told in the Torah itself. That's not true with Moshe. And what I'd like to do is study Moshe's early years and talk about the role that justice and wonder as an incredible combination play in creating what I believe is a Jewish hero. And I do think, especially in this time where heroes for kids tend to be celebrities and athletes, that it's important to share our heroes at the Seder table. And it's important to share Jewish heroes throughout time and really to help in the in that line of continuity is to suggest to our own children, what does it take for you to become that hero? I see, Rabbi, you have a little hero right there. And if we're speaking about Jewish continuity, we want to welcome everybody of all ages to study together. So I'm going to do, what's his name?
This is Ami Brand, who is coming to visit the Shir.
Ami, I'm so happy to have you. I'm so happy to have you. He's a prop in the Vehigata Talavincha of today. And you should all know that that I requested that he be here. All right, so I'm going to go to my screen share. And what I want to share with you is a quote and a beautiful painting, a very unusual painting. I love to look at paintings as I teach. First of all, on Zoom, I think the visuality of it helps us put ourselves in the story, and it also helps us understand what did an artist think about this story. So we'll begin with the novelist, with the writer Justina Chen, and she said there must be a few times in life when you stand at a precipice of a decision, when you know there will forever be a before and an after. And I'm very struck by this because I think that this is a summative rendering of what happens to Moshe and Moshe's life, particularly at the Sneh, at the burning bush, where he gets his mission. And at the time of Bnei Yisrael's incredible before and after moment in Perek Yud Bet in chapter 12 of Shemot, which we're going to look at together momentarily. And I'm going to invite you to think about, and if you want, please drop it in the chat, a moment, a before and after moment for you when you were at the precipice of a decision and that you understood when that thing happened, whatever it was, whether it was the developing of a new relationship, whether it was the positioning of a new job, whatever it was, that there was a before and after, and that when you went through this experience, you would never be the same. So if you're looking at this beautiful painting, this is done, it was probably done in the early 1600s by Pedro Arente, and it's Moshe and the burning bush, or I said Moses and the burning bush. And it is an unusual composition for a number of reasons. I would say the most significant of which is that the artist has chosen to do this almost like a reel of film, right? That it's only 10 inches high and 42.4 inches long. So it's a thin sort of almost like a scroll. And the artist has chosen, if you like, to, I'm gonna make the demarcation down the middle of the painting, that that the artist has chosen a left side, which is a very pastoral scene, which is the before of Moshe's, of this moment in Moshe's life. Moshe was walking with the flocks of his father-in-law of Yitro in Midian. And then there's a right side, which begins to be that paints a picture of Moshe's future. So there's the past and the future. And if you look, the artist, here's the bush, and you can see that the leaves are not consumed. You see a sheep here who has no idea what's going on, right? And that's one of the tricks of being a shepherd, is that you and the sheep are really in very different places in your life. And I say that because the shepherd is the MBA of leadership in the Torah. And that's the way, and the shepherd has to be sensitive to all kind, not only to the needs of the flock, the predators, the struggles of individuals to stay within the flock, the weather, the pasturing, the terrain. And it was, there's something that makes it a perfect metaphor for leadership, for Moshe's leadership, and of course for all the shepherds of Sefer Bereishit who came before him, is the tending of the flock later on in Moshe's life, when Moshe knows that he will not be crossing the Jordan. He begs God to make sure that there is a shepherd to accompany his flock. So you'll see something that I think is very majestic in this painting. There's fire here that is the same color as Moshe's shoulder, where the artist has painted a lot of light and drawn our attention into Moshe's bare feet at this moment. But look, there's almost an arc that's created between God's light, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's light, and Moshe's arm, that they're somehow in this moment going to be joined in perpetuity. And I'm going to look at that event, but we're going to look at it in a few minutes. So let's look at the Jonathan Sacks Haggadah. Rabbi Sacks, I try to bring in his Torah in almost every shiur. He was my thesis advisor when I lived in London, and I had the great, great zchut of studying with him. And his loss has been immense for world Jewry and immense for me personally. So he says, to ask is to believe that somewhere there's an answer. We ask not because we doubt, but because we believe. So the questions at the Seder, and maybe we'll, if we have an opportunity to talk about the Rasha, the wicked one who sort of doesn't, speaks from doubt rather than belief. But our questions aren't because we're questioning the fundamentals at the Seder of belief, but because we're inviting a posture of questioning and curiosity. And that is typical, that is embodied by Moshe's experience at the Sneh. And before we get there, right, this, what I'm going to call the threshold moment, the before and after moment, where there's a liminal space, which is the threshold, I want to talk about the importance of threshold experiences and Pesach as a threshold experience. This is written by a friend of mine, Sherry Hirsch. She wrote a book called Thresholds. And she said, we've spent a lot of time traversing the hallways and crossing the thresholds, both in our homes and in our lives, moments when we're in transition, those moments when we're standing between the way we're accustomed to living and a new way of thinking, feeling, and being, moments when we're preparing to enter a new room to take the next step on the journey of our lives. These moments can be disorienting and scary, sometimes painful or even heartbreaking. Other times they can be exciting, hopeful, and filled with possibility. Why do some of us struggle to cross while others don't? Pesach, as a crossover holiday, it's literally that crossover, and we're going to talk about it from Moshe's point of view, from God as Pesach, God's passing over, and B'nai Israel's passing over, the Israelite passing over. On all of these levels, it is painful and disorienting and scary and exciting and hopeful and filled with possibility. And so I love seeing Pesach as a time at the Seder table where we think about our own threshold moments that had these components to them, and when we crossed over and our lives opened up and changed in powerful ways. So we're going to look for the moment at the experience that B'nai Israel have of this crossover. And I just took some selected psukim from Perek Yud Bet, which I think is really, you know, I think it's the crux of the entire Yitziat Mitzrayim experience. And we talk a lot about the plagues, the makot at the Seder, but we talk less, although we, of course, hold up the Pesach, our Zeruah, and in honor of this Pesach. But really, I'm going to invite you this year to deepen your experience at the Seder of this Perek, which is the creating the moment of readiness for transformation. V'lakchu min adam v'natnu al shtei amezuzot v'al hamashkof, al habatim asher yochlu otam bahem, וככה תאכלו אותו במתנכם חגורים, מתנכם חגורים נעליכם ברגליכם, מקליכם בידיכם, נורץ עוד אחר, יו, ואכלתם אותו בחיפזון, פסח הוא לשם. So we have this sheep, we're keeping this sheep in our home for a number of days, and then when we shecht this sheep, we're not only, we're going to talk about the shechting of the sheep, but we're shechting the sheep and we're taking the blood of the sheep and we're putting it on our lintels, on our doorposts, on the place which is the most liminal place. It's not in and it's not out. It represents the place of ultimate transformation and transition when we go through there. The Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim talks about the significance of shechting a sheep as the Karban Pesach, because the sheep was revered in Egypt, much the way the cows are revered in India. So the Rambam points to the shechting of the sheep as the ultimate iconoclastic act. You are destroying the Egyptian god, which is a statement that you are making on your way out, which is an affirmative commitment to Kadosh Baruch Hu and this life, this brit that we have made long ago that is continuing now into this generation. And of course, when you shecht the god of Egypt, you're also not wanted, as you're seen as a distant and threatening entity. So there's a really important, the Korban Pesach is really important in establishing our larger commitment to this new after, and also this idea of putting blood on the doorpost. So I want to talk about the doorpost for a second, because I am a big believer that Pesach is a great time for a mezuzah campaign. Buy a mezuzah for a friend. Check your klaf. It was the idea of a mezuzah, and this only came to me in adulthood. I was not a mezuzah kisser until later on in my life, and I'm going to explain to you why. I started studying the expression of the petach, the doorpost in Tanakh, and the idea of what happens at the threshold moment. And for many people, there are doors of anxiety that we go through all the time. It might be the door to a doctor's office. It might be the door to college roommate, right? It was the door that we cross. It might be the door of marriage, of our first home, or it might be in building a new home. It might be in a job interview, right? There are all these doors of anxiety that we cross regularly. And we tend to go through even large doors as individuals. And it's a very lonely experience. And I think that Judaism, one of the gifts of Judaism, is that Judaism ritualizes anxiety moments, whether that's crossing over from childhood to adulthood, and what could be more distressing than having acne, having your voice change, and knowing now that you have to give a speech in front of a few hundred people, right? That's anxiety producing. So Judaism comes in at marriage, at a brit, at death, and says, we're going to front load this with a lot of rituals to help you get through the anxiety. But we have that not only in terms of Jewish time, we have that in terms of Jewish space. And this experience is the ultimate embodiment of that. And when you go through that door of anxiety and change and possibility, we tell you, you're never alone. The Shin Shaddai of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with you in this crossing. And also the mission statement of the Jewish people is with you in this crossing. And that means that you're surrounded. It's like a stereo sound of God's love and your people who have been through anxiety before, who've been through difficult moments, and we're going through this moment together. So, and I see as I've aged, I've appreciated what these doors, these various doors and hallways of life that we cross have much more meaning. And that initial door experience here as a collective is never more present for us than at this moment in time in Pesach. So I'm gonna go back to our screen share. And here you see the readiness. We rarely get details of stories. For those of you who are interested, Eric Orbach wrote a really important book of literary criticism, Mimesis, and he has a specific chapter, Odysseus, a Scar, where he compares Homeric literature to Hebrew literature, to biblical literature, specifically to the story of the Akedah. And he says, in general, the Bible is extremely economic in its language. And so we don't have a lot of details about how people lived or what they wore or what they did. And yet here we have this, the way in which readiness is communicated is that we gird our loins. And by the way, if you're not sure how that happens, there is actually a website and you can look up a YouTube video of how to gird your loins. If that's your thing to prepare for Pesach, go for it. Putting your shoes on your feet, putting your staff in your hands. It was, this isn't only Moshe's mateh. This is everybody is preparing for this moment to leave quickly. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says something that's, I think, very striking. Vayah adam lachem la'ot. We tend to think that the blood was so that Moshe, so that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would understand that a Jew lived in this particular home, which is not true for any of the other makot. But here, I think it says something very significant that sometimes we miss. Vayah adam lachem laot. I've done lots of otot moftim, B'nai Yisrael. Right now, you need to make your own oat. You need to make your own sign of the significance of this moment so that you can pass over. Let's now look at just the first petach in the Torah, just as a reminder. It's when Cain is very, very angry that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has rejected him and rejected his karban, and says, "V'lama naflu fanecha?" God says, "Like, lama charalach? Why are you so upset? Why is your face fallen?" Halo im teitiv se'et. I need to tell you something, Cain, about the nature of this world and the nature of free will and the nature of consequences. Here's the basic message. Philosophy, moral philosophy 101. If you do good, you will be uplifted. Vimlo tetiv, and if you don't do good, lepetach chatat rovetz. It was, I need to tell you where sin is going to live. It is living in the threshold, right? Because threshold moments are very scary. And understanding your feelings at this very passionate moment is frightening. But if you take a moment and you understand that sin is crouching at your doorstep, v'alecha tshukato, and you will desire it. Notice earlier language here from Sefer Bereishit, v'atatim shalbo. But you can control it. So at the threshold always presents opportunities to make decisions. Are you going to go in? Or are you going to back out? Or who you're going to be as you cross through this door? Now, of course, Cain doesn't listen to this message and he goes out and he kills his brother. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants him to understand and wants us to understand that important things happen in these threshold moments. So let's go to Moshe. And I told you we're going to talk about Moshe's early life. But in order to do that, we're actually going to start at Moshe, the end of Moshe's life. V'lo kam navi od b'Yisrael k'Moshe. There'll never be another prophet like Moshe, asher yado Hashem panim el panim. Here the translation says, whom God singled out. I don't love this translation, right? Who knew Moshe, right? God and Moshe knew each other, panim el panim, face to face. I want you to pay attention, please, to that verb, yado. It's going to come up in important ways in Moshe's early life. And it really becomes a bookend in the close of Moshe's life. And I'm going to share with you what I think are two sort of radical ideas that are countercultural. The first radical idea that I want to share is that prophecy has almost nothing to do with the future. It's true that our prophets, some of our prophets, did warn of things that would happen in the future. But by and large, we have come to think in society of a prophet as a fortune teller, right? As a Madame Marie on an Asbury Park boardwalk. And that is not what a biblical prophet is. A biblical prophet looks intensely at the present. In fact, many of the quote unquote predictions of the future are really based in the behavior of the Israelites in the current, right? In the moment, right? In the current moment, in the present. And so what I want to share is Moshe's capacity to be the most enduring prophet of Jewish life has to do with his capability of looking at difficult things in the moment in which they happen. And to that point, I want to share with you, I think, a very, very important article about prophecy that comes out. It's the introduction to Rabbi Avraham Yehoshua Heschel's two-volume work, The Prophets. He writes, What Manner of Man is the Prophet? So I just wanted to take a little clip from there to emphasize the point. To us, a single act of injustice, cheating in business, exploitation of the poor is a slight, to the prophets, a disaster. To us, injustice is injurious to the welfare of the people. To the prophets, it's a death blow to existence. To us, an episode, to them, a catastrophe, a threat to the world. And he talks about the fact that a prophet has myopic eyes, large eyes in which he scans the present, and large ears so that he can hear injustice. He hears the cry of the poor, right? He hears the cry of the orphan and the needy. That is the role of the prophet. So with this understanding that the role of a Navi is predominantly to look very carefully at the present, let's look at Moshe's early story. And I know that you know this story. We're just going to do a close reading of much of it to sort of highlight things that I think go into the making of a Jewish hero. The first is the first verb. Now, we looked at one verb, yada, right, to know, and that will come up. But the first verb in the story, vayelech, will become the Germans call a leitwort, right? The repeated drumbeat of a word in a chapter of Tanakh that tells us something critical about the behaviors. And this is going to be a yitziyah story. It's going to be a story of movement. So we begin the story of movement with movement. Veilech, that a man doesn't say vikach, don't say that later. Veilech, you go, why do you need veilech vikach? But veilech is going to frame our entire parak. This man, we don't know his name, we only know that later. He leaves Beit, he comes from, he's a Levite, and he goes and he marries a woman who's a Levite. So the lack of names, right? Moshe only gets his name 10 verses in. His sister Miriam doesn't get a name here, and his parents don't get named in this parak. And one of the things that Martin Buber, who wrote a beautiful book on Moshe, and we'll look at a piece of his book momentarily, he writes that when you're looking at the early life of a leader, you want to look at his leadership influences. And he believes, Buber believes, that what we hear in this chapter is not so much about names and then get distracted by the names. But what we learn is that Moshe will land in three leadership homes in this chapter. He will be the child of Levites. He will go to Pharaoh's house, and they will end up in Kohen Midian, in the priest of Midian Yitro. So Moshe will see three different models of leadership. And if you want to learn to be a leader, it's important to be mentored by different types of leaders. It's important to see different types of leaders. In fact, in much of the work that I do, people tell me, I learned how to be a manager, or I learned how to be a leader, or I learned how to be a CEO, or I learned how to be a head of school by watching people I did not want to be like, right? So that model also helps you. So if you're looking at how could Pharaoh be a model for Moshe, well, looking at someone's leadership qualities who you don't respect also helps you understand the formation of your own leadership and who you don't want to be. V'tahar isha v'teled ben. This woman conceived and she had a son. V'tireh oto kitovu. And she saw kitov. And Rashbam, Shmuel ben Meir, Rav Shmuel ben Meir, who is Rashi's grandson, directs us to the other place where we know this term, Kitov, and that's in Sefer Bereishit, Perek Aleph. He doesn't make any comment there, but if I could make the comment and join the two, we see in the beginning of Exodus a reversal of aspects of Genesis and an augmentation. So, for example, we read Pru Urvu Umilu Et Haaretz, and in Perek Aleph of Shmot, we hear that terminology used with the addition of Vishritsu Vyatzmu, right? So, and we read that on the Seder, we read that in the Haggadah. So we're linking these stories together, the birth of the world and the birth of a nation. But something is very, very critical to understand at this moment. And that is, this is after the declaration that all male children will be thrown into the sea. So if you had a boy at this time, I don't think your first words would be kitov. They wouldn't be mine. They would probably be oive, right? Those are my two words. Oh my goodness, I had a boy, had it only been a girl. But Moshe's mother, with this language, tells us something very critical about Jewish leadership. It is the belief that even in desperate times, the birth of a child, every human being is tov. That type of optimism, of futuristic belief that maybe things aren't good now, but that every child is good, is critical in understanding how you create someone who's like Moshe. How do you make a Moshe? You believe Ki Tov. Now let's look. We're going to do a little bit of hopping and skipping. There's three terms and something to think about when we use the tzafun of the Haggadah. V'titzpanehu, we refer to this experience of hiding, and v'lo yechlu od hitzpinu, right? And she couldn't hide him anymore. And then later Moshe will hide the Egyptian. So hiding will become important in this chapter. She puts him into this into this basket, and she positions Miriam merachok, from a distance, ledea mayeselo. So I told you there's a few verbs we're going to pay attention to. One of them is lalechet, and one of them is ladat. So she wants to know what will happen. And something rather remarkable happens. Vitered ba paro lirchotz al yaor v'narotel holchot. Remember, v'elech holchot al yad yaor v'tire et ateva. So the three verbs we're paying attention to, ladat, lirot, and lalechet. And in fact, what I meant to point out is our first appearance is that Moshe's mother sees. She looks carefully at him. Now, Bat Paro will see the teva, and she will take it. V'tiftach v'tirehu, and she will look at this child, right? And I want to point out something that I don't know why I didn't think about before. And I read it in a commentary. I can't remember who said it, which I feel bad about. But it may have been Nachum Sarna in his book Exploring Exodus. I'm not sure. The fact is, Moshe was not likely the only child who was sent out into the Nile. Which Jewish parent would dispose of a child, would drown a child? In fact, I imagine that every Jewish parent was doing the same thing, putting a child in a basket, making sure that that basket was secure and watertight, and then sending that child into the sea. Whatever befell him was not an act of murder, chas v'shalom. So here, if you're thinking about this idea of Bat Paro seizing upon this particular child makes the miracle all that much greater. V'tireyu et hayeled, she looks at the child. Minei nar boche, and the child is crying. V'tachmol alav, right? She says she has rachmanut on him. V'tomer miyaldei ivriim ze, right? She understands that this is a child of the Hebrews, right? Ivriim, right? The people who cross over, right? Who make those transitions. So let's think for a moment. Moshe's mother gives Moshe the belief in goodness, right, that comes through sight. And Bat Paro, the proto-mother, right, because she will take him as a son, looks at this child and sees in him, or is able to feel for him, tachmol alav, has rachmanut on him. This is perhaps one of the most subservient acts in all of Tanakh, is that the daughter of Pharaoh has pity on a child who her father declared is a non-person, must be treated as a non-person, must be murdered. That, and you have to wonder, getting that family dynamic of what goes into this sort of tense relationship between this woman and the dialectic tensions that have formed between the past, her father, and his wretchedness, his wickedness, and Moshe, this child. And she sees she doesn't focus on the suffering perhaps of the nation, but she sees one child suffering, and she's able to give that child back to its mother, back to Moshe's mother, in order to be nursed, right? So she sees that child. And then Miriam works her wonders, and look what she says. Ha'elech, should I go v'karati lach, isha? In other words, should I go and call a Hebrew woman without saying it's his mother to nurse her? V'tomer laba paro lechi, another, lechi, v'teled ha'amla, right? Go, and she went, right, to call the mother of the child. V'tomer laba paro halechi et hayeled, take this child, right, hazeh, and nurse, have the child nursed. She gave her money, and they went on their way. Small detail, but involves that sense of, it really deepens the idea of having compassion in very, very specific and detailed ways, right? It's not the general sense of, oh, I feel bad for someone. The Torah tells us, you feel bad for someone, then make sure that compassion walks with you. It leads you to do something, to take care of someone in the details, right? V'yigdal ha'yeled, and we're going to see that expression twice. And this, when the child grows up, which we assume is the age of three, the age of weaning, she's brought to Pharaoh's daughter. And watch, v'yila levain. I said to you that she took him as a son. A lot of us forget this detail, that she actually, it wasn't only that she cared for him, she adopted him and she gave him a name. Of course, that name would be very important because it would signal all the ways in which Moshe in the future would rescue people through the use of water. Now, Vayehi b'yamim ha'hem, and we don't know what happened in those days. Of course, Chazal jump in. They're always interested in what happens in intervening times that makes Moshe Moshe. V'yigdal Moshe. Now Moshe grew up. There are two levels of his growth. One I would like to suggest is his physical growth, which is suggested in the previous pasuk. But in this pasuk, I think this is his real emotional and spiritual maturation. V'yetze elachav. He moves. He goes out to his brothers. V'yar b'sivlotam. And he sees them in their suffering. Bayar ish mitzri make ish ivri me'achav. Now, of course, again, there's the collective suffering, which he sees, but then there's the hyper-focus on the suffering of one individual, because that's really, we can't solve every problem. And I think it's the Torah's way of suggesting, this is what social action really looks like. Look at the big, big picture, look at the suffering, and then hyper-focus on one act of suffering, and step in and do something about it. So ish mitzri makeh ish ivri me'achav, bifen cho v'cho vayar kien ish. Now look here, Moshe sees, right? Vayar, vayar, and he looks again, vayar. He is the ever-sighted person. And then he sees two Hebrews fighting with each other, right? And he suggests that they stop fighting with each other. And then he realizes that he has been seen himself, right? Vayar Moshe, right? Vira Moshe, right? He realizes that he has been seen and he's frightened. So we connect those words, those homophones, and understand that sight and fright go together. And he hears something from them that he will hear, because I believe all of Moshe's leadership in some way is foreshadowed in this chapter. He will have someone, his own people, who he is risking his life. He's risking his life to save them. And they turn around and say, who are you to do this to us? Who do you think you are? Right? Now, Pharaoh hears. He's about to kill Moshe, right? He wants Vivrach Moshe. And again, movement. Moshe flees. And he, watch this. V'yishev be'eretz Midyan, v'yishev ala be'er. There's two verb changes here that are important. Twice we learn Moshe flees. And finally, just be Moshe for a second. Oh, the exhale, the sitting down at a well, right? At a place of nourishment. But Moshe will not sit long, because it's uncharacteristic of Moshe to sit long. Moshe, who himself has to be careful, sees a group of women who come to pasture their sheep, and he sees that there are shepherds who are harassing them, and they're perhaps taking their place, right? The long line of people who may be waiting to water their sheep, v'yirgashum, and he pushes them away. Now, this is important because he will name his first son Gershom, right? So this experience of banishment, he's able to visualize it. And in some way, it encapsulates for him the justice that he must perform in the world. Vayakam Moshe v'yosha'an, right? He is the one who gets up and he saves them, right? Now, I'm not going to look at the rest of the story, although all these details are important. Moshe sits with his father-in-law. He stays with his father-in-law. Again, another Lashevet. And he gets his wife, Tzipporah. He has a son named Gershom. Now, to name a child Gershom as the sum total of your experience, Ger Haiti Be'eretz Nachriya, it's like going to a bris and naming your child alienation or dislocation or polarization or marginalization. In other words, you're naming your child after the experience of injustice that you have witnessed, that you've experienced, that has been the story of your life, right? Because you have been left your parental home, right? You were put on the Nile. You were banished you were taken as a child into a household, and as an act of and as a consequence of your act of justice, you have been banished from that household. He is a stranger from every place that he's been in. And then we have this very strange ending. Vahi biyamim harabim haheim, biyamat melech mitzrayim, v'yanchu b'nei Yisrael min avodah, v'zaku v'tal shavatam elohim min avodah, v'shma Elohim et naktam, v'zkor Elohim et brito et Avram et Yitzchak et Yaakov. All of a sudden, if we were using a video camera, we would move from the picture of Moshe's early life, following him in the steps that he's taken, and now the camera shifts, and it goes to the Israelites crying, and really it's God hearing them for the first time. Vayar Elohim, look at this, Vayar Elohim, V'yeda Elohim. God sees and God knows. Now could it be that God didn't see and God didn't know? I'd like to suggest that the power of human sight in some way will be a catalyst for God to see and to hear. I'm going to stop the share to talk to you about a beautiful reading of Rav Soloveitchik's on this strange story of Moshe and then story of Bnei Yisrael being heard. Because Bnei Yisrael were servants, slaves, in the first chapter. Why didn't God hear them cry in the first chapter? So I used to daven in Maimonides' school in the shul in Boston when I was doing my PhD there. Rav Soloveitchik was no longer healthy and dominating in that shul. Ebedee Shtender was there, and there were a number of people who had tapes of Rav Soloveitchik's very lengthy shiurim that he gave in Boston, many on Motzei Shabbat. And I knew I was doing okay when one of the holders of the tape said, "Erica, I want you to listen to this before Pesach." And it was a 4-hour shiur, and it was amazing. And I want to share with you an insight from that shiur that has fundamentally shifted the way I think about leadership and justice. So Rav Soloveitchik says, how do we explain this sudden shift in focus in Perek Bet of Sefer Shemot? And he says, the way he explained it was looking at a child on a playground. Child is on a playground, and the child falls down, falls off a swing, falls off a slide. He looks to see if a parent is watching. If a parent is watching, the child's going to have a gesunta cry, because you don't want to waste an opportunity for a little bit of compassion. If no one sees the child and no one's looking, the child will, sort of brush off the wood chips and get back on the slide. And he says, if you look at this metaphor as a way of explaining the experience that the Israelites have at this moment and the way that a leader transforms their lives. He says, look at this parak. In the first chapter of Shemot, Pharaoh has this terrible decree and Bnei Yisrael are really suffering, but they don't cry. It doesn't say they cry. In other words, they don't cry. And one of the reasons that they don't cry, according to Rav Soloveitchik, is that there is no leader to save them. What is the point of crying if there's no one here to hear your cry? No one human to hear your cry. No one who looks like you, who has rachmanis on you. He says, what did Moshe bring to this? With the very appearance of Moshe on the scene. This is someone who, who made you a sar v'shofet aleinu. But at the same time, something changes in the air. Some electricity, something happens for them when they understand that Moshe was willing to risk his own life, his own safety, his life in the palace, his comfort, to go out, not one day, but 2 days, to look carefully and to do something about it. That's the person you want on your side. And the minute that happens, he says, something happens to Bnei Yisrael. They begin to cry. They begin to cry. And once you cry, someone else can hear you. If you have a problem and you don't tell anybody else, you can't complain that you're not getting the help that you need, because we're not mind readers. You need to cry. You need to tell me I need help. And then all of a sudden, you know how Baruch Hashem, the Jewish community works. You hear someone, right? Someone says, a gomel and shul, 100 casseroles on the doorstep. That's what we do. But sometimes people keep their pain deep, deep within themselves. And he says, that is the gift of a leader. The gift of a leader is the very presence of a Moshiach, a savior on the scene, enables people to reckon with their problems, to name them. And so Rav Soloveitchik says, they move from silence to the primitive animalistic cry of pain, to the articulation of pain through tefillah, za'aka, to the advocacy, shalach et ami, to the shira of Exodus 15. And what a gorgeous, gorgeous understanding. For Rav Soloveitchik, he writes repeatedly in so many of his books and articles that the experience of ge'ulah begins with the word, begins with language. He says, what is the job of the leader? The job of the leader is to move people from silence to an expression or articulation of pain, to advocacy, to song. And that's what Moshe does. It's just the most beautiful thought, right? And I want to share with you, I was just learning this morning, I was reading Rav Sacks's beautiful Haggadah. And he says, long before Moshe encountered God, he went out to his people and watched them at their hard labor. This was the birth of his active identity as a Jew. Though many Jews in the modern age found it difficult to believe, they identified with the Jewish people. They fought its cause and gave it their support. Belonging, he says, is the first step to believing. What makes the wicked son wicked, according to the Haggadah, is not that he fails to believe, but that he fails to identify with the people of whom he is part. Right? Belonging is believing. And we have that beautiful experience here. I want to go back to my screen share, with your permission. And I want to share a few secondary observations about Moshe's leadership and sort of tie this together. So this is from Nachum Sarna's wonderful book, Exploring Exodus. Three incidents in Moshe's life occurred while he was still attached to the palace are given prominence in the narrative because they reveal aspects of his character and disclose his commitments. Having witnessed the labors of his kinsfolk and become sensitive to their sufferings, he cannot tolerate the sight of the Egyptian beating a Hebrew. This outrage against decency and human dignity spontaneously arouses in him feelings of anger and resentment. His instinctive indignation at the maltreatment of his brethren has effectively overcome his self-interest. And once again, he cannot remain indifferent. His spirit rebels against the abuse of the weak by the strong. So when you're looking at why Moshe is given this task, it's that Moshe is both of the people and outside of the people. He can observe what they're experiencing and he fights on their behalf. Three incidents of social justice where Moshe did not have to do anything, but Moshe throws himself into it, in fact, complicating his own self-interest. Let's look at something that Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg says in her beautiful book, Moses, A Human Life. When Moses speaks on behalf of Israel, then he acts as a proxy voice, amplifying and supplementing their inchoate sounds. In this role, he's forgiven for his irreverent tone. He's recognized for a new genre of expressiveness. He lends vitality to the people's inertia. I love that. He lends vitality to the people's inertia. He's not of them, nor is he like them. He's separate from them, reared in a different world. And yet he is in some uncanny relation with them that allows him to give voice to their despair. God strikingly responds, I too have heard the naka of the Israelites, as though to say, you are not the only ones to care about their fragility. Once Moshe has given voice to their strangled cries, God declares himself an ally in empathy. I want to look now quickly at the experience of the Sneh, because it's the ultimate experience of seeing. Moshe ya ro'e et hatzon yitro, chotno, kohen midyan, binhag et hatzon, binhag, right? He leads them. This word does not appear often. And here it's manhig in contemporary Hebrew is a leader. Achar midbar vayavo al har alim choreva. So he appears at this mountain of God. Vayar malach Hashem elav. And again, look at that seeing, right? And malach of Hashem appeared to him. Belabat ish mitoch hasne vayar. And he looked. Vines nebo erbeish, vasnen en ukal. It's like, this is a wondrous thing. But what's more wondrous is what happens next. Vayomer Moshe Asarana. Moshe sees from the periphery of his eye something happening. But you know how Moshe is. He is a full-sighted person. He always wants to look. Look here, ere, mare, right? See that seeing again. But this time he has to turn in order to look. He has to leave his job, right? And you see that was communicated beautifully in that painting where the sheep are to the left side and he is turned aside in order to be full-sighted at this moment. Madua, look at that term, yada here. Lo yiva'er asne. And he asks this question of curiosity. This is unusual. What's going on here? Now watch what happens next. Vayar Hashem. Because Moshe looked, God looked. Kisar lirot. God saw that Moshe turned to look. God wanted, a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants a leader who turns to look at things. And not only look at injustice, the worst of humanity. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants someone who has the capacity to look at wonder. And God calls to him from the sneh, and he says, Moshe, Moshe. And he says, Hineni. I want to look at something that Buber says in his beautiful book, Moshe, the Revelation and the Covenant. He says, the name sneh, which is peculiar to it, there's no other bush that is called this. So you're not going to find another sneh. Echoes the name of the mountain, which is omitted of set purpose at this point. The word sneh repeated in the same sentence suggests the name Sinai that is used when the nation reaches the mountain in order to receive the revelation, right? So here we have Moshe at the sneh, which the flame of the sneh, which will reflect in language the flames of Sinai, right? Of Sinai. That same word is used. So I want to share, I'm going to stop my share, the second sort of assumption. I told you some radical assumptions that everything that happens to Bnei Israel has to happen first to Moshe. He becomes the embodiment of the nation, that he will have to undergo his process of change and transformation that will then become mirrored in the transformation Bnei Yisrael experience in Perek Yud Bet of the book of Exodus. That Moshe will experience the seeing and the turning and the mountain and the flames will be experiences that Bnei Yisrael will also have to experience later in their leadership. But why does any of this happen? Because Moshe looks. He looks carefully. The word hashkafa, lahashkof, mashkif, right? Mashkif, the mashkof, right? The lintel is really related to the word for seeing. It's all about careful penetration, careful looking at something. And when Moshe dies in Devarim Lamed Daled, there are two things that aren't taken from him, which I believe is the Yerusha, what he has left us as the legacy for life in Eretz Yisrael. And the life of a Jew, its strength, his strength wasn't taken from him. And he could see, he died fully sighted, right? His capacity to see, his vision still lives with us because Moshe was taken and those things, those properties that he had, even at 120, were still as sharp as ever. There's a beautiful, beautiful way in which we look at Moshe's vision. Again, prophecy is not about seeing something in the future. It's about seeing something in the present that other people don't want to look at. And I want to say the third assumption. We've seen since last Pesach a world on fire. A world on fire politically, a world on fire racially. We've seen protests, we've seen harm, we've seen suffering. And Baruch Hashem, we have taken the lessons of Exodus and understand that once you go through that yitziah, you have to make a yitziah parent and obtainable for everybody else who is suffering. And my word to social justice warriors is, don't forget that Moshe didn't only look at what was wrong with the world. He looked at what was right with the world. That's what made him optimistic. He was not afraid to take some time off of work and look at wonder and say, Ma hanora, how great, how revelatory is this moment, right? How could this act of nature happen? Unfortunately, a lot of people who fight the wars of justice don't also embrace the world of mystery. And that's our Yerusha, is that we see injustice and we see wonder. So today, as you're cleaning, and thank you so much for listening. If you're listening and learning with me today, we have a mitzvah that we can only do in Nisan. Wouldn't it be nice to do it today with our Pesach preparations? Because that's our act of wonder, is to go to a tree, a fruit tree that's blooming in Nisan, and make a bracha you can only make one day a year. That's really the way that I started my Haggadah, because I felt like Chag Aviv, let's just celebrate it. And I have to say, now in our second year of a COVID Pesach, I'm feeling that need to connect to nature and to connect to wonder more profoundly than ever before. So here you see the life of Moshe. What a beautiful life. What an honorable life. What a noble figure to look up to. Someone who could see injustice and see wonder and hold those two sometimes contradictory impulses in the same person. Someone who could contain multitudes, and as a result of that, could take us to places we could never imagine. Only those who see the impossible, only those who see the invisible can do the impossible. And that's the legacy he left us, to see what is invisible and to do the impossible. And I wish you a sweet, joyous, and very healthy Pesach.
Thank you so much for sharing your time, your wisdom, and your inspiration with us. We wish you as well a beautiful Yom Tov, a Chag Kosher v'Sameach. Look forward to seeing you here. Please, God, when you can come visit in person.
Amen.
And we look forward to being in touch. Thank you so much. We're going to, please, God, follow in those of ways.